Jay Padgett-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
And this is radio station WBAI in New York. Time now for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you for the next hour, as we do every Wednesday night. Joined this week by Jim.
Hello.
Red Hacked.
Hey.
Mike.
Hi.
Red Bird.
Hello.
Arseny.
Hi.
And Walter.
Howdy.
And don't forget Bernie S. and Laszlo over in Germany.
Good evening.
And where's Laszlo?
Laszlo is sleeping.
Oh.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Well, that's not very considerate, is it?
Well, we've been through a lot, I'll tell you.
So what are you doing over there in Germany? Trying to get away from here?
Well, it's getting pretty bad over there. But in any case, we couldn't even escape because of how bad it's there with the blizzard. It took us hours to depart from Kennedy due to the blizzard. Air France just couldn't spray enough ice off the plane.
You know, I cannot believe that's when you were trying to travel, was during the crazy surprise blizzard we got yesterday. You always have really bad luck getting out of here sometimes.
It was unreal. We were sitting in the tarmac looking out the window, and it was just insane. At one point, a small plane that was landing got lost and landed on the wrong runway, and it just screwed up the whole airport because this plane couldn't seem to find its way back to where it was supposed to go. And so we didn't take off until about 3 hours later, and, of course, then we missed our connecting flight in Paris, which was going to go take us to Hanover, Germany, where we are now. And basically, we got here many, many hours later than we'd hoped. But we're here now, and everything is fine.
Now, that brings us to the question of why you're there.
Well, we are here for CEBIT, C-E-B-I-T, which is the world's largest telecom and IT conference. And Laszlo and I come to this every year now because it's quite the gathering of telecom and IT people. Among others, our friends Rob and Barry the Key will be demonstrating their cryptophone again, as they did last year, to many curious people around the world. And it's just an amazing gathering of people from countries all over. A lot of countries that you wouldn't see in the United States showing IT and telecom technologies, countries like Iran and Jordan and other countries that might not be welcome to the United States are actually here to freely show some technologies they have. A lot of nonprofit organizations, too, like the Fraunhofer Institute, who developed MP3 technology, will be there showing off some really amazing technologies that they've developed. So it's a lot of fun and a lot of interest, and we're going to be stomping around for 3 days trying to cover as much as we can.
Now, I understand that this conference gets even more people than show up for the HOPE conferences here in New York. We get, what, about 2,000, 3,000 people showing up?
Well, you would get 2,000 or 3,000 people at the HOPE conferences and maybe a bit more at the European Hacker conferences. This has just a tad more people, a little over 500,000 people attend this conference. I think last year they had like 540,000 people attend. I don't know if it'll be bigger or larger this year, but...
That is bigger.
It's kind of big. So it takes several days just to cover the acreage.
And I assume they're not all staying in your hotel.
No, we almost weren't staying in any hotel because there was some mix-up, and the hotel lost their reservation. So it was really bad. But it was really bad because there are no hotels, as you can imagine, with 600,000 people descending on Hanover, Germany. There are no vacancies anywhere. I sat next to a cement salesman on one of these Air France flights.
You have been traveling, yes. We can.
And he told me, the cement salesman told me that when he was in college, he used to rent out his flat for the weekend for 3 days for CBIT attendees and just cook them breakfast, and he would make enough money that few days to pay his rent for the whole month. So it's very competitive to stay anywhere in this section of Germany this time of year.
Well, how did you pull it off if they lost your reservations? You told them who you were?
We basically shamed them into it. Laszlo was sharp enough to keep documentation of who we spoke to and all that, and they basically had to kick out some Danish guys that they gave our room to.
You've made enemies for life with that.
Well, we didn't
move.
Actually meet the. We weren't. Fortunately, we didn't meet the Danish guys, but stuff happens.
You will. I'm sure you will at some point. So, any problems getting over though from security issues? Were you flagged with S's or anything like that?
Actually, no. It was surprising. We made it through. There were no S's on our boarding passes. There were some semi-related passport issues when I tried to purchase a SIM card from T-Mobile when I got here. The phone that I purchased in Thailand a few weeks ago, a GSM phone I brought with me, but I didn't want to have a Thai number because that just complicates things. So I bought a T-Mobile SIM card for it, so I'd have a German number here so I could be reached by you and other folks, even though I'm on a landline tonight. But T-Mobile now has a new policy. Apparently, they will not sell a SIM card or minutes to you without showing your passport.
Really?
Yeah, and giving them your other information, like your address and date of birth, which is on your passport, and a bunch of other stuff. And I asked the salesman at T-Mobile, who seemed pretty up on this stuff. He said, yeah, this policy's been in effect, actually, for a couple of years now. But I haven't run into this before. I certainly didn't have this problem in Thailand. You can just purchase your SIM card in minutes. But apparently it's a peculiar T-Mobile requirement, not a government requirement in Germany. So I didn't really have much of a choice if I wanted to have a mobile phone access. So I just gave them my info, but I was uncomfortable about that. I'm just hoping I could just pay cash and be anonymous in my communications, but apparently that's not possible with T-Mobile in Germany.
Interesting. Well, you do have other choices. You didn't have to use T-Mobile.
Well, we didn't have any choices because last night the only place that was still open in this little town called Celle, C-E-L-L-E, ironically.
That is ironic.
This town called Celle. In the Celle of a town, that was the only carrier that was still open that could sell us a SIM card, so I had to lump it.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess life is full of compromises. But,
yes, it is.
Let's cover a couple other topics that listeners have been very interested in, as things we've covered over the past couple of weeks, including something involving Bernie that we talked about last week. Here's a letter from Chuck from Boston who writes in, I heard your show last week about Bernie S.'s encounter with the New Jersey ticket maintenance people and how they didn't want him to photograph the inside of the machine. That's right, Bernie getting in trouble in yet another city. I can see why they may be concerned. That is a money-sensitive unit, and they may be afraid you will use the photos to break into the machine. Also, someone called and mentioned that in Boston someone was drawing the Fleet Center and had their drawing taken by the authorities. I'm from Boston. There's a scam going around with people posing as cops by flashing fake badges and holding what looks like a police radio in their hand, but is actually a handheld CB radio. They're demanding ID and then stealing women's purses and wallets. Here in New York, they shoot you. Well, the real cops do that too, but the fake ones apparently are following in their footsteps. There have been several instances of this up here, so no cop is going to take your drawings or cameras away. If you're approached by a person who says he or she is an officer, request a uniformed officer to be there too. And then we have this letter from someone who counters that by providing this example. I just listened to the most recent Off the Hook episode. One of the segments was about a ticket technician threatening to take Bernie S.'s camera. I witnessed a similar situation several months ago. I saw a tourist taking pictures inside the Chinatown Metro station in Washington, D.C., soon after a police officer appeared and asked to see the photos that were taken with the digital camera. He then told the gentleman to delete all the pictures taken within the station. The police officer stated that it was forbidden to take pictures inside the metro. The man complied while the officer looked over his shoulder. Then the officer thanked the man and left. Well, so seems to me like the cops are doing this, or that might have been a fake cop in Washington, D.C. as well. But
well, he wouldn't have gained much out of it, so.
No, not really, except maybe a good laugh.
Yeah.
The question is, forbidden by whom? Apparently, in many cases, it's being forbidden solely by the person saying that you can't do this. But until you really push and investigate, you'll find out really it's not forbidden by any law. So sometimes you have to question people, which is a little difficult when the person's wearing a uniform and carrying a gun, as in my case. But, you know, just a little general persuasion finally digs up the truth, and they'll be a little chagrined when they find out that, well, they don't really know what they're talking about.
Well, here in New York City, there is a proposed rule to ban photography in the subway system. I don't believe, from what I've heard, and I've been looking for any information on this, I don't believe a decision has yet been reached, even though one was supposed to have been reached several weeks ago. So as far as I'm aware, you are still completely allowed to take pictures in the subway system, and people should test that. I know we've been testing it. In fact, somewhere in here I have a really, really good website where you can take a look at that yourself. In fact, if anybody else has websites to share with us with pictures within the system, within the subway system, please let us know. And I'll find
it. It could be a secret law, too, like the law that requires the so-called law that requires Americans to show government photo identification when they board an airplane, even to travel domestically, mm-hmm. which John Gilmore is challenging, and the government refuses to even say what the law is. And I don't want to see that start happening with people who want to take pictures of things that are in the public domain, for there to be secret law.
Well, I don't understand. The Gilmore thing is incredible because the government is saying this. It would be so easy for them to simply advise airlines to make it airline policy, and then such cases wouldn't even be possible to be brought against them because airline policy says you must show ID. Just like, I believe the Port Authority, PATH Trains, you're not allowed to take pictures. Is that right, Redbird?
As far as I know, you're not. That's the one place where I'm pretty sure that it's illegal to take pictures.
And that's because it's PATH Authority, the Port Authority people. It's their policy to do that. There's no secret law or anything like that. It's something that's
that brings up a whole other issue as to whether this is public property or private property. Is PATH property actually, you know, do they have the authority to say you can't do that when you're a public citizen on public property? It's what's curious around the Amtrak station at 30th Street. There's signs that say this is a private facility. Now, as far as I know, Amtrak is a government corporation, which is primarily funded by federal taxpayer dollars. So I don't think it's a private facility, and I really question the validity of these signs that even says this is a private facility and what we say goes. So that's worth investigating, too, I think.
I agree. It is worth investigating.
Well, there's clearly some rulemaking authority that the MTA has. I mean, they're allowed to make rules that say you can't jump over turnstiles and whatnot, but I don't know how far that authority goes.
Well, that would be fare evasion, so that, you know, that would fall under, you know, actual laws of theft of services sort of thing. But, you know, if you're a public citizen who's expressing their First Amendment rights to gather and express information or express their artistic talents by taking pictures, I think that's a legal issue in and of itself. And I don't think a government agency can say to a public citizen on public property that you can't exercise your legal rights. So it's really an interesting thing, and a lot of times this comes down to just because we say so. And that's not good enough for me, just because somebody says so without really showing whether something is legal or not.
Amen. Justin from Connecticut writes in with the URL I was looking for the photo blog of New York trains, subways. It's www.travisroos.com. I will spell that. Well, the www is obvious. .travisruse.com. And it's basically a blog with photos taken inside the New York City subway system. And most of the photos are really kind of cool, you know, good portraits of people. Obviously, without permission, because some of them look like they're ready to kill the person taking the picture of them as they're getting off a subway train or something like that. We need to see more sites like that. It's really kind of cool. Again, travisruse.com, TravisRuse.com, photo blog of New York City subway trains. Interesting.
We tried to get a good picture at the airport in Paris this morning. Well, yesterday, actually, our time. But we thought better. There were some attractive women at the Paris airport walking around with machine guns. With some really imposing-looking Heckler and Koch machine guns.
Hang on. What? You just kind of sparked my interest here. When you say they're walking
attractive women with machine guns, well, sparked your interest?
Well, I mean, you know, apart from commercials for various types of, whatever. The thing is, were these people uniformed people or just casual citizens walking around?
Well, no, these were actually uniformed.
Because I've been to Paris, and it's a very interesting place.
These are very... these were military officers. Of men and women. But we just, you know, attractive women caught our attention in general. But in Paris, but these were attractive women in uniforms carrying imposing-looking machine guns, walking around. And we just, I don't know whether we thought that was a welcome sight or not, but we just thought it was interesting. And if people are going to be carrying machine guns in the United States airports, we'd kind of find them more interesting to look at if they're attractive women. But in any case, it caught both Laszlo and my attention.
Okay, well, I'm sure something else is going to catch you, too. Did you take pictures of them? Or?
Well, I wanted to, but I really thought better. I mean, it was the uniformed personnel at 30th Street Station in Philadelphia last weekend. Was it last weekend or the week before last? Whatever. These were guys that were just carrying sidearms. So, I don't know, there was something about... great big machine guns that seemed more imposing to me. And plus, there could have been a language barrier thing, and I might not have been as persuasive as I might have been with in the United States as I was last week or whenever that was. So I just thought the discretion would be a little better policy this time.
Probably a good idea. Okay, we have a bunch of other letters. I just listened to your March 2nd show where you read my letter regarding the new entrance policy into the Walt Disney World theme parks. I heard one of you ask if I had to use my fingers later in the park. Aside from Emmanuel's comments about using them again, which I did, of course, I never had to repeat the process of inserting my two fingers into a machine at any other time while I was at the park. However, we did go to the Magic Kingdom the next day, and I had to repeat the process, put in my ticket, stick my two fingers into the device. But, of course, I didn't have to buy a new ticket, since you can use the same ticket for multiple days at any of the Disney parks. You just pay for the number of days you'll use a ticket. Signed, Tom from Chicago. Anytime we talk about Disney, we always get a ton of mail from people that experience these things or actually work there. Donna from Orlando writes in, I heard your last show about the Disney World fingerprint machines. I work at the gate at Disney, and we have had this in place since about the late 1990s or so. The reason for it is so nobody tries to sneak into another park without paying. Or if they need to leave the park for some reason and come back, they can be ID'd as a paid guest. We do not put any fingerprints in databases, nor do we match anyone's fingerprints to any outside database. I thought I wanted to let you guys know, since you seem concerned about privacy.
Well, I mean, they must put it into a database temporarily, otherwise
right.
It would be useless, but...
Yeah,
it has to be stored locally, at least for your duration of your stay at the park, or as he said there, it would be pretty useless information.
What if you've had an untoward event and your fingerprints have been burned off, or you're an amputee and you have an artificial hand, or you're a criminal mind and just happen to have put something over your fingerprints so it's unreadable? What happens then?
I think it just reads your from what this reader or listener tells us who works there.
It reads whatever is presented?
It's your finger geometry. It's not your fingerprints, actually. It actually measures the size and shape and spacing of your fingers, whichever fingers they are. I don't know.
Well, an unsigned listener writes in and says, it scans your index and middle fingers and uses a geometric formula to come up with a number that will identify your fingers. The calculated number is apparently something that is not totally unique, but is statistically insignificant in identifying you. I was only able to play with them for a brief time, so here's what I got. After you buy a ticket, I bought a Park Hopper 2-day pass. You line up for these finger scanners. You enter your ticket on one side and then put your finger in the scanner. The scanner has two pegs on a base. I didn't see any apparently Okay, I don't know what that means. It measures the length between your index and middle finger. You put your hand in, and once the first peg reaches the groove in between your middle and index finger, you must squeeze your fingers together. Once the computer gets a reading it can use, it spits out your ticket on the other side. Boy, if only the NYPD used a system that was that quick. It took us like a half hour to get our fingerprints done during that fiasco.
If there's a listener who can try this out, I'd be really interested to see what would happen if you just used, you know, like a fake rubber hand or something with just those two fingers, or maybe just two plastic tubes that were shaped like fingers, inserting them into the proper orifice or whatever you're supposed to put them into, and seeing if that works, you know, if it's repeatable, and whether it actually has to be your actual fingers or whether they can just be some finger simulators.
I'd like Donna from Orlando to get back to us and let us know if there's a metal plate on this thing and the pegs are plastic, because the Department of Corrections uses something like that to verify one's ID when you're on probation.
Yeah, but I think that actually scans your fingerprint. What she's saying is it looks at your just hand geometry. In any case, I just think it's the whole concept of inserting one's fingers to enter the Magic Kingdom is just intrigues me.
Well, entering the Magic Kingdom at all intrigues me, but it's just so bizarre and crazy. Continuing with this letter, there's a magnetic stripe on the cards. I can send one to you if you'd like. Would you like that, Redbird?
Absolutely.
All right. Which apparently puts that information onto the card. I tested it to see how good they were, so I tried using my girlfriend's card, and she tried using mine. I pushed the first peg with my finger and squeezed it together to make it seem like I had shorter fingers, but it didn't work. Funny thing is, the people who were working there at the turnstile, retired old folks, let me do this and didn't care. They just smiled, laughed, and let us go after we switched our cards and entered. These tickets are used for speed passes, where you can go to a ride and reserve a seat on the ride at a later point in time so you don't have to wait online, kind of like an easy pass. It can show a lot about people's movements through the park and whatnot as well. In order to use those features, you must do the finger scan, though. Of course, you can use your picture ID to get through, but you won't get the speed pass features. Interesting.
No, wait. Go ahead.
If security isn't that great there, maybe somebody can take a picture or get the make and model of these scanners, and then we could actually find out what it is really reading.
Way ahead of you. The pictures are right here. Someone sent us a website that basically is entitled Disney Security Cameras and Searches, with some high-resolution pictures here. Security at
Our
Disney World starts. Yeah, they are. Starts from the moment you enter the property. The picture above shows security cameras mounted on the parking toll booth. One camera is placed at eye level so it can get clear pictures of your face as you stop to pay the attendant. The other is aimed at the rear of your car. It captures your license plate as you drive away from the booth. Disney security officers will search every bag, fanny pack, and purse prior to entering the park, and there's all kinds of pictures there. And this is on www.anycities.com/user1/Disney-World-Disney-World-Orlando-something that begins with SE. URL got cut off, I'm sorry. But I'll pass those pictures around for the benefit of the people
now,
inside the studio.
One of the letters seems to state that the information is actually stored on your card on the mag stripe. So I didn't realize there was a magnetic strip on the ticket or whatever it is. So, I mean, theoretically, where it's something like the Metro cards, where the value or the number is stored on your card to identify you, as opposed to in a database somewhere.
I don't believe it. I bet it's stored in a database.
I don't believe people take this so seriously. Disney World, that is.
If there was any doubt that this is like the Atlas Huxley vision of the future was correct, I mean, people just need to go to Disney World.
Well, I mean, I guess it does have some effect, because the one time I've been to Disneyland when I was 8, we did, you know, have someone go into the park, or 3 of us went into the park, and then one person went out, and 10 minutes later they came back with somebody else using the same tickets that we'd used to get in, so...
It's because of that they've implemented these Orwellian things now, so
right.
People can't get
but
away
I'm just
that.
Saying that the fact that they match you to your ticket actually would, I mean, just from my own experience, it was possible in the past to sneak in using the same tickets from different people.
Yeah, you know, worse things can happen than people sneaking in, but apparently it's very important to Disney that these massive security things be implemented.
It could be a matter of national security.
It could be. It could be. Getting a free ride in Disney World is it's only the first step.
There is a Disney national security nexus I've found. There's a good book that just came out entitled Chatter. It's about eavesdropping in a post-9/11 world by government agencies. I recommend it. It's kind of the genre of James Bamford's The Puzzle Palace. But in any case, there was a chapter that described the NSA's sort of decline in technology a few years ago, and they brought in experts from different corporations on IT security and code breaking, that sort of thing, and they brought in someone from Walt Disney Corporation and gave him like full security, just walk anywhere he wanted to in the NSA, which I thought was stunning, and that these old school code breakers were just floored that their work was being reviewed by a Walt Disney employee.
Yeah. It sounds silly when you say it that way, that's for sure. Okay, moving on. A lot of other topics to cover here. The BTK killer. We've all heard this story about this serial killer who was finally caught. And apparently the only reason he was caught after so many decades of being on the run or just being out of the reach of law enforcement is because he communicated again after being silent for so long. And the authorities were able to trace his communication because of the computer he used. Yes, this reader writes in, what on earth does the BTK killer have to do with computers or hacking? Apparently he left a digital signal somewhere. I can only speculate as to what gave the authorities their lead, but here is one theory that is being tossed around. If he used Microsoft Word to type his letter, then a username and company name would be in the header of the doc file. This might be what led the authorities to the church computer that was used. It will be interesting to see what exactly was used to trace the origin of the disk that was sent by the BTK killer, signed M2 Mike. Does make you think, you know, if you're going to send that anonymous threat or communicate to somebody, there's all kinds of information stored based on the computer you're using, based on the program you're using with that computer. All kinds of information can be sent that you might not think is being sent.
There's some new info on how this might have come about. Apparently, the alleged BTK killer allegedly used a reformatted diskette, one that had previous information written to it, and he allegedly reformatted it. And allegedly wrote the letter to whoever this was on this disk and gave it to, I guess it was the media or the police he gave the disk to, but using various tools, DOS tools, you can, or Norton Utility Tools or whatever, you can unformat a disk and read files that were really, not really deleted, but when you format a disk, it doesn't really erase what was on there. It just marks that information as being erasable next time you need to write to that diskette. So apparently the BTK killer didn't cover his tracks too well this time when he reformatted the diskette, and forensics might have tripped him up.
The amazing thing about this whole case is that the authorities are saying, yep, we caught him, we did our job, but the fact of the matter is, for decades they hadn't caught him, they weren't able to find him, and really he kind of made it easy for them by sending them this this message. I think what a lot of people don't realize is just how easy it is to find somebody when they send something like this, whether it's over the internet, whether it's a disk that's sent in the mail. Pretty much he advertised his presence, although he probably wasn't aware that he was doing that. Now, according to an article that appeared in ZDNet Australia, anonymous internet access is now a thing of the past. A doctoral student at the University of California has conclusively fingerprinted computer hardware remotely, allowing it to be tracked wherever it is on the internet. In a paper on his research, primary author and PhD student Tadayashi Kono said there are now a number of powerful techniques for remote operating system fingerprinting, that is, remotely determining the operating systems of devices on the internet. We push this idea further and introduce the notion of remote physical device fingerprinting without the fingerprinted device, device's known cooperation. Is anybody surprised by this? No, I don't think we are, but maybe our listeners are. Yes, anyone want to comment on the implications?
Well, I mean, it's kind of cool because a lot of hardware, you know, with all the mass production of it, is pretty generic, and it used something to do with the clock of I don't remember the specifics, but basically, like, the fact that all this generic hardware, each piece has some little difference with it that you can fingerprint it. I mean, since everything is mass produced, is fairly interesting, actually. I mean, everything is being, you know, you just got factories pumping out motherboard after motherboard, chip after chip, and they're all pretty much identical. But the fact that there's slight differences that you can use to pinpoint a certain machine is pretty interesting, actually.
He comments in his paper, one could use techniques to help track laptops as they move, perhaps as part of a carnivore-like project. Now, carnivore was internet surveillance software built by the U.S.'s Federal Bureau of Investigation. Interesting things to look forward to, where basically you could be tracked rather easily.
Along those lines, there was a decent non-technical article in the Sunday New York Times this past Sunday about the increasing use of false ID by people who are finding it easier to make fake ID, driver's licenses, that sort of thing, with readily available computer hardware and software. And the police were seemed stymied by the fact that people could actually encode their own mag stripes or encode their own two-dimensional barcodes and that sort of thing. And it was really a good article about the cat-and-mouse game between the government entities trying to make foolproof government IDs and others who are trying to make IDs, not so much for terrorist purposes, but just so they can get a drink. But it's a good article. I recommend checking it out.
Well, the barcodes are pretty easy since they're a standard. I mean, there was a thing a while ago. This guy, he's got this website, Voltage Labs, and the New York State IDs have two barcodes on them. One is a two-dimensional barcode with all your information, and then there's a barcode at the top that just has your birth date, which is the one that's generally scanned by anybody that has a barcode scanner. And that's just the, I believe it was a code 128C barcode, which is just a standard barcode type. So if you found a way to cut out your barcode and replace it, you had something that said you were a different birth year.
And it would be a felony in New York State to do so, believe it or not.
Just saying that the fact that people can make their own barcodes, they use standards generally.
Oh yeah, and that's you can just go online and find and generate a code 128 barcode. You know, it's trivially simple to do. I just find something that's that trivially simple to do that doesn't necessarily harm anyone can actually be a felony and put you in jail for years. It's intriguing that it's so easy to land yourself in jail these days.
I've actually found that most of the magnetic stripe technologies that are being used, a lot of companies are using obscure formats that aren't generally able to be read by commercial products, and that's actually was part of our MetroCard decoding project. Is the MTA uses this obscure format that you would never be able to normally read using a standard magnetic stripe technology. So I guess that's a step forward, but it's the same, you know, security through obscurity method that eventually it'll be broken.
By the way, a reader writes in asking, has Redbird released the specs / schematics for his cheap portable card reader he's mentioned a few times on the show? On the December 29th episode, it's like a court transcript here, of Off the Hook, at precisely how many minutes past 7 o'clock, he mentioned that he'd release them eventually. If so, I'd love to see them. Signed, Daniel.
Yes, I believe they'll be out in the next issue. I kept meaning to say it on the air, but we always ran out of time.
Okay, well, that's the official word, the spring issue, which is being worked upon now by 2600, which should be out sometime before summer, hopefully. We'll have that piece of information. Related to subway issues, we talked last week about the crazy maps that are out. We went on a little expedition after the show last week, and we were able to find a bunch. This reader writes in response to your question where people can get the subway maps showing the venues for the 2012 Olympics, which are never going to happen here in New York. You'll be glad to know that last Friday I found many maps available at the token booths at the Times Square 42nd Street Station. Hopefully this information proves helpful to you and your many listeners. Signed, Nick from Woodside. Nick, thank you very much. In fact, that's exactly where we went before reading your letter, and we were able to find a few. We actually had to sort of override the initial negative response that we got. I think, Redbird, you were able to figure out that they were in a booth, even though they told you that they weren't in that booth.
Right. They seem to have only gotten one or two boxes at the not-so-popular token booths, and they may be keeping some of the more popular ones stocked with them. And I have no information as far as if this is going to be a regular release of one of the maps, because it does say, you know, service changes as of February 2005, which are slightly important. But other than that, nobody seems to have any information.
Janine writes in asking, will we be doing a panel at the Trenton Computer Festival this year? I enjoyed your panel at last year's Trenton Computer Festival. And yes, Janine, we will be there. In fact, we'll be performing an edition of Off the Hook. I don't think it's going to air on the radio, but it'll be sort of like a private screening of Off the Hook. We're just going to be there hosting the show, except we'll be in front of an audience instead of in front of microphones. And that's
there are microphones in the room.
Well, yeah, so okay, not radio microphones. Those actually are there. I've had to bellow a couple of times. I don't know if they
there were microphones.
Sometimes there are. It depends on how big the room is.
Would the addition of Off the Hook leave the room?
I don't know. If someone tapes it, I suppose we wouldn't be able to prevent that, would we?
That's an excellent idea. Tape it and post it on the website, but never air it on radio.
How about that? That could be our fate, actually, in the future. Yeah, so whenever that is, I don't have the exact date in my mind. I know it's in April, and the people come on after us, personal computer folks, they certainly know the actual dates. Also, was that Martel Cognac in Freedom Downtime additional footage DVD? I really enjoyed the Paul Sojourn. Well, I can't comment on that because that would violate the rules of the contest. What contest? Well, you're asking the next question here. Have you posted the Easter eggs from Freedom Downtime yet? No, we have not, because it's part of an ongoing contest which is taking place. In fact, you can read about it in the current edition of 2600, Winter 2004-2005, and it'll be posted on the website fairly soon. Basically, we have a whole bunch of Easter eggs on the Freedom Downtime double DVD set. And if you were able to find the most, and anybody affiliated with the radio show, anybody affiliated with the magazine in any way, as far as staff people, not people who write in, but people who work in the offices or various other things, they are, of course, exempt from having to play in this contest and don't help anybody or anything like that. This is a contest to see who can find the most Easter eggs. Easter eggs being something that... that may not be noticeable to the casual observer. It could be anything from hitting a certain button in a particular way to finding a particular thread of things that are going on that might not be so obvious to people who aren't looking for it. What will you win? Well, you win all kinds of things. There's only a first prize. There's no second prize because coming in first is what matters. You'll win a lifetime subscription to the magazine, all the back issues, every piece of clothing that we sell. Off the Hook DVD with more possible Easter eggs on that. Another Freedom Downtime DVD, because you will have worn your other one out by constantly looking for things. And two tickets to the next Hope Conference in 2006. The address, if you have a Freedom Downtime DVD set and you'd like to play this contest, find as many Easter eggs as you can. Mail it to Freedom Downtime Easter Egg Hunt, care of 2600, P.O. Box 752, Middle Island, New York, 11953. And what's the deadline for this? The deadline is September 1st, 2005. So you have plenty of time, but it's going to take plenty of time.
After September 1st, will we then publicize the facts?
Yeah. Well, okay. Of course.
Good.
There's nothing to lose
then. Well, that's all we can do. So.
Yeah. Okay. What else? Bernie, you wrote in with an interesting piece about some guy on ABC's This Week calling for the death penalty for hackers. What's that all about?
Oh, the guy who replaced William Sapphire in the New York Times columnist. I forget his name. John, what does it say? Well, I wrote it in. It's 1 in the morning. Forgive me. I forget his name.
Last name was Tierney.
Yes, John Tierney. T-I-E-R-N-E-Y. There was a discussion about the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision that executing people who committed crimes as minors for that crime was unconstitutional, which I happen to agree with. I think death penalty is unconstitutional anyway, but that's besides the point. He was claiming that, that might make sense. He personally feels that hackers and their viruses should be executed. And I wasn't sure whether he meant hackers and the viruses themselves should be executed along with the hackers, but he seemed to have the opinion that the only good hacker is a dead hacker, and he didn't differentiate virus writers from hackers. And
hackers and their viruses should be executed? Is that how he said it? Because if you execute a virus, that's how it spreads. You know?
That was what was so funny about his statement. He clearly did not know what he was talking about on several fronts.
He wasn't joking then.
It was maybe half in jest, but he seemed quite serious about wanting to execute hackers and their viruses. So, you never know what you're going to hear on Disney News or a Disney TV show, such as This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Yes, Jim.
I'm going to step into the big chasm here and get myself into trouble sometime in the future. But I'm going to say, if anybody out there knows anything about John Tierney, like where he lives, his bank account numbers, his Social Security numbers, anything else, send it to us, because right now
send it to Jim, because we don't care. Why do you want this information?
Well, I figure there's right now, despite his best efforts, there's no death penalty for hackers, so we might as well make his comments worth the effort.
Speak for yourself. Anyway, so that's if anybody has a tape of that, I'd sure like to see it, or even audio tape. I'd like to know just what exactly who's calling for death penalty for hackers outside of China.
This guy has also done things like impersonated bank robbers and gotten into cabs with large amounts of money and a hood over his head and a fake
why is,
gun.
Wait, why is
what?
He doing that? and now
it's
he's
on, this guy's kind of nutty.
Okay, I guess that's a prerequisite of being on national TV. Okay, we also got a lot of feedback to last week's discussion on movie ratings, and we've done some research since then. I'd like to read a couple of letters and then open the discussion up. And we'll be taking phone calls right after this, 212-209-2900. Off the hook, many theater owners comply with ratings because it is written into their lease that they will only show MPAA-approved films, that is, no unrated films and no NC-17 films. The NC-17 rating was invented because leases exclude X-rated films. It wasn't long before leases were updated to exclude NC-17 movies. That's why that rating has also effectively disappeared. Hollywood created the whole rating system to avoid government regulations, signed David. I'm not sure. I don't know if how these leases tie into this. Seems kind of sketchy to me. Another listener writes in saying the MPAA system is a guideline for consumers. Everyone plays along so the government doesn't get involved regulating. The TV and video game rating systems are the same. I don't know how much better it is in government regulating when you have all these films being categorized by such a narrow group of people and severe penalties for not playing along with the quote-unquote voluntary system.
Well, the people who benefit are not us, but the industry itself, which is why they are such a fan of creating their own systems mm-hmm. that they can control, even though to the consumer the net effect is the same. But I think the industry doesn't like to have government watching what it's doing.
But, I mean, what is the industry? The industry is the mass appeal type things. Well, independent filmmakers certainly doesn't benefit.
No. By the industry, I mean the what is it, six big studios?
Mm-hmm.
Are there still six?
It might be three this week. Yeah. I don't know. Depends who bought whom. Now, Arsene, you've done some research on this. Tell us what you've found out.
Well, I've done a bit of research. I got the submission forms for a film. I was just very surprised that if you make a movie with a $50 million budget or over, you have to pay $15,000 to get your film rated. But that's an absurd amount of money to go to a rating board, which it's the same no matter what kind of movie you make.
So wait, you mean these guys, not only do they get to see free movies, but but you have to pay them to see free movies?
Yeah, you have to deliver your film to them. You have to do it on time, too, or else they get really mad.
Okay.
you have to deliver it at 9 a.m. and pick it up at 5. It's like they just get to hold on to it for a day.
All right, so now it's based on your budget. So a film like Freedom Downtime, which deliberately was not rated.
Yes.
Our budget was, what's the lowest budget there?
We figured that Freedom Downtime would cost $1,500 to rate.
$1,500. We'd have to pay them to tell us what our film was rated. Oh, that's precious. What else have they told you?
Well, I'm going to do some more research on how to actually join the committee.
Uh-huh.
I'm not 100% sure about the details I have, but I got an email address of someone that should clear things up for me.
Well, now, from what I understand, it's a handful of people, literally a handful of people, maybe
it's
two handfuls.
It's an average of 10 people.
Okay.
From 8 to 13.
Okay, so some people might have. But the thing is, these people all live in Los Angeles, right?
Well, the area. As the woman I spoke to said, we do not fly people in.
Nor do they have people watch movies in other cities. What I'm trying to say is, the value system of people in Los Angeles, and I'm not necessarily criticizing people who live in Los Angeles, although I could be at a later date. The people in New York have a profoundly different set of values than people in Los Angeles. Yet what you're saying here is that every movie that comes out is rated based on the value system of the people who live there. And not only that, all of these people are required to be parents?
They have to be parents.
They have to be parents. So every single movie is rated by parents. And I assume there are no gay parents in there.
Well, we don't know that for sure. And maybe by next week we will understand what they mean by parent.
Yeah, I'd sure like to know more about that. Of course, these people are completely anonymous. We don't know who they really are. It could be a computer program for all we know. But I just find it amazing that everything is so strictly defined by such a small group of people, and nobody questions this. I would like to see an alternate rating system come out by people who are not parents, you know? People who have values from living in New York instead. What would it take for that to be taken seriously?
I will rate your film for you for $1,000.
Well, that's just it. If we charged half of what the MPAA charges, all right?
No, I'm going to undercut it entirely. No matter what your budget is, I'll rate it for $1,000.
Okay. All right. Fine. $1,000 per film.
You have to send me a DVD because I don't have a fancy screening room.
Fine.
But,
let's splurge. Let's allow VHS as well.
I don't have a VHS.
We'll get one. We'll all get together.
We'll rent out a little studio someplace, and people can send us, it doesn't matter how big or how small you are. People send us these movies, pay us the fee. We watch the movie. We give it a rating. But what would our ratings be? Our ratings would not be the same. First of all, we can't use those ratings. R is registered. The letter R is registered. PG-13 is registered. But, I think the film should be rated based on something else entirely. I don't think any film should be rated because of language. Everybody hears language. Language is simply words, and that's I don't think that's a valid reason for rating a movie. Anybody have ideas on what movie should be rated
for? I say we color code them with different shades of white.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a design issue. But, you could rate something based on how much violence it has, right?
Well, let's rate it based on the threat to national security, something we talk about. We can base it on the green to red code.
Now, you're being silly. I'm being serious. I'm trying to come up with an alternate system. I think this whole
physiology.
Physiology?
No, listen to me.
I don't think you're being serious either.
No, listen to me. Listen to me. A series of numbers from 0 to 100. One number would be, how much does this film wake you up? All right? That could be violence. That could be language, whatever. Another could be how much it provides blood flow to the naughty bits.
No, I'm definitely going to assume you're not being serious here. I'm going to hope.
No, really, really. 0 to 100. If there's no sex in it, that number would be 0. But the physiology number would be 100 if it's violent. Bombs, explosions, shooting.
Yeah.
Or attractive women carrying machine guns.
Well, the thing is, whenever you rate something, you're imposing your own values on it. Like, for instance, I would like a rating that warns me if there's like family based sappiness in a movie. Okay. Now, I'm not sure what I would call that. What kind of maybe rated
G?
F or something. just because that's the kind of thing I can't stand. Just like, for instance, when you have channel blockers on your cable TV set, you can never block the Christian channels. They don't let you do that. You can only block, the R-rated things. But the things that upset me are the G-rated things, the stupidity, the mindless drivel that's out there. I'd like to block that. I'd like to rate that in a particular way. I don't know.
You could rate it C for I can't talk. Christian values.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Overly religious overtones. That's another one that could be in there. Religious rating. So as you can see, the values, at least from this particular room in New York City, are profoundly different from the people that are rating movies in Los Angeles. I'd like to actually do this. I really would. And the thing is, if it actually were taken seriously, then people would have something else to base movies on. It would have maybe two ratings. It would have the MPAA rating and the Off the Hook rating.
I'll tell you what, for a package deal, for $1,200, you can get all these ratings that we've proposed.
Well, no. I think your original proposal was that we're going to rate it.
We'll give you the one rating for $1,000, but all the ratings for $1,200.
No,
it's a good deal. It's a good deal.
But I think you get all the ratings because you're rating a movie based on all this criteria that we're coming up with. Well, I don't know. We can sort out the details.
With them, you get one letter. With us, you get a whole damn page.
Yeah. Something that
if you're a filmmaker and are interested, send us an email, oth@2600.com.
All right. 212-209-2900. Let's take some phone calls. And good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, about the film rating.
Rebel, where have you been? Hold on a second. Nobody knows where you've been. We figured Al Qaeda got you or something. What are their demands? Are there any?
Let's see.
They just want us to take you.
Yeah. Did
anyone try to shoot the hostage?
What? No, seriously, Rebel. We haven't heard from you in ages. You haven't been to the meetings, is it something we said?
No. Well, I just...
Is this Rebel or is this an imitation?
Well, I think you could tell when I'm imitating.
We can tell when Rebel is imitating, but maybe you're not... All right. Let's assume for now you're him.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
I noticed that, what do I want to mention? I should have wrote down what I wanted to say.
That's Rebel.
That's Rebel, all right.
Let's see. Using a phone is so annoying. Listen to what happens when you want to call the operator. I'm dialing 0 from my home phone.
Rebel has his own radio show going.
dialing zero.
You're going to get James Earl Jones. We all know this.
No, no, you're going to get...
That's James Earl Jones.
For emergency police, fire, or...
That's not James Earl Jones.
That's a... Isn't that annoying? Like,
it's like somebody's trying to strangle him or something.
Or to build this call to another number, press 2.
I like, hello, and people have been dialing 9 by accident and getting 911. I mean, when you dial 0...
Wait, you're saying if you dial 0, then you can dial 9 to get 911?
Right.
That's kind of strange.
That is strange.
It's easier to dial 911.
Right, I know. Didn't you hear it say to for problems with your bill, call dial 1 or do something else, dial 2? When you dial 0, you used to get whatever it is, the operator, local operator. And now it's all this.
Speaking of Bell Atlantic and other phone companies and things like that, do you know, if you call a busy signal and you get that little recording saying you can dial *67 to have it call you back, not *67, *69? No, what's the one? *66, right?
66.
Yeah. Basically, it says you can have Bell Atlantic keep trying this number and call you back. The recording has not been updated. It still says Bell Atlantic.
It's an old recording.
It is an old recording. Anyway, nice to hear your voice again, Rebel, and nice to hear the next voice, too. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
What's up?
Winston Smith here.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Hi. We spoke before.
Okay. What's going on?
I'm 38 years old. I finally got a computer for the first time, and I was surfing the Internet last night for the first time. It's a profoundly masturbatory experience.
Yeah, and let me apologize for it in advance.
Anyway, I'd like to rate the most odious movie I ever saw, Bad Boys 2.
Okay.
It should have an O.
And
O,
for odious.
It was disgusting.
Okay, we can use O because the MPAA doesn't use O.
Yeah, O is a good one. How can I get in touch with you guys? I have some photographs of subway trains from the late 70s to the late 90s that I think Redbird would be interested in. And I have some other things I think you'd be interested in, Emmanuel, but I don't want to discuss them over the air.
Well, you can reach Redbird personally, redbird@2600.com. You can reach me,
Emmanuel. Hang on, 2600.com.
Yes.
I'm a novice at this. Okay, and you?
Emmanuel@2600.com, and you can reach the show OTH@2600.com. OTH standing, of course, for Off the Hook.
Okay, once I figure out how to do that on my computer, I will do that forthwith.
You can also, if those are physical photographs, mail them to us physically.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't think I want to do that. I think I'd rather scan them and send them to you because they're kind of valuable to me.
Not a problem, then.
Okay. God, I have so much I'd like to discuss with you. Over the past couple of weeks, I haven't listened to you, but...
let's get your top issue. Because
yeah, the federal institutions. I had some experiences. There's an embassy near the UN in the 40s between First Avenue and Second Avenue. I think it's the United States mission to the UN, and I was walking by, and on the side there's a car entrance, and they have like a little blockade that can come up from the ground.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I was looking at it, and in about 20 seconds, a GSA officer, I know from the badge that he was with the General Services Administration, came out and yelled at me. He was pretty abusive, and I was really just looking at it.
Oh, because your eyes could have been cameras.
Right. Well,
wow. So now we got to worry about staring at things.
Right. And this is a couple of years ago. There's an institution on 12th Avenue in the 20s. It's a detention center. It's a federal detention center. And I was looking at the door, and there were cameras, and I was reading the placard, you know, to see what the institution was. And a voice came over an intercom. Telling me to get the hell out of here right away.
Bernie, is this the DEA thing you found?
It's definitely a detention facility. When I was up there last Sunday in New York, or Sunday before last, I did run across a DEA museum, which is apparently still open. It's supposed to have closed, but I saw through the windows, you could see some of the big picture windows. You could see some of the propaganda displays of the DEA. It was
I remember there was something in that neighborhood in the on the west side in the lower part of Manhattan.
I understand their headquarters is on 57th Street between 10th and 11th or 9th and 10th.
No, this was not their headquarters. This is like a special commercial exhibit for people to learn DEA propaganda, basically.
Bernie, I thought what you found was something that was kind of hidden, something like a warehouse.
Oh, yeah, that's over in the Chelsea district.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking about on 12th Avenue in the 20s. This is definitely a detention center because it was a heavily fortified building.
All right, we'll have to check that out or be sent there or something.
All right, guys, I'm going to try to get in touch with you. Great show. I love your show.
All right,
bye-bye.
And let's see if we can squeeze in a couple more in the time we have left. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, what's up?
Hey, I had a very interesting experience. I was cleaning out my garage, and I came across an old analog bag telephone that I had from Bell Atlantic days. I hooked up to a battery charger I had, and I dial a number. I get a message saying, you know, welcome to Verizon Wireless. And it said I could make a collect, calling card, or credit card phone call using it. And I was like, wow, I didn't know you could do that. So I called Verizon up and asked, tried to get, you know, what were the rates? And first they asked me to have an account with them. I said, no. Then they kept telling me, no, you can't make collect phone calls from a cell phone. I said, but I got this message when I you know, turn on my old analog bag phone.
Uh-huh.
And they hung up on me like 3 times. They didn't tell me anything. So I called my friend up, and I called collect. It was like $3.99 a minute. Do you guys know anything about that?
First, yes. I've heard of it. Barney, what do you know?
Yeah, it's up to the discretion of the mobile telephone carrier in your area, or carriers in your area. But if you have an old analog, or AMPS, stands for Advanced Mobile Phone Standard phone, like a 3-watt bag phone, which are really good phones. They're really powerful and have great audio fidelity. The carrier can allow you to make calls even if you're not registered on the network as an active user that pays month to month. And it's really good to carry one of these phones for emergencies because you can still make 911 calls anywhere, and they have to be carried. The FCC still requires cellular carriers to carry a analog AMPS call. So it's the main reason a lot of people carry a phone around in their car is for emergencies only anyway, but you don't have to pay a monthly fee. So the cellular carriers don't want you to know this, but it's a great 911 accessibility option to have this phone with you at all times in your vehicle or wherever. But some carriers will let you make calls using a calling card, not like the prepaid kind, but the ones issued by them. Or you can make collect calls. It's really up to the carrier. But it's these old analog bag phones are still very useful for that, and you can find them at flea markets or ham fests for, you know, $5 or $10. So they're worth having.
Okay, Bernie, we're just about out of time. I want to wish you and Laszlo the best over there in Germany.
Laszlo has just woken up, and we're going to be heading to Leipzig and Dresden and Prague over the weekend.
Okay, and we'll be back next...
Yo!
Good night, Laszlo. Nice talking to you. Will you guys be back in the States next week?
Yes, next Thursday we'll be returning.
Okay, so next Wednesday you might be somewhere interesting.
We'll try to be reached.
Okay.
Reachable.
Great. Well, have fun over there. This is Emmanuel for Off the Hook. Again, you can write to us, oth@2600.com. Snail mail, Off the Hook, care of WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York.
10005.
See you next week.
I am studying UCD types behavior. Hey, girl, it's Minion Paul. You can't wait, huh? Perhaps I'll flee my babe to chase her. Go, cat, go! In the pigeon hour. Go snap your wings to chase her. You sold your time, but I still got mine. I'm from the spam, but I want to see mine.
Yeah. Ooh, hoo, 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 hoo. Hey. Hey, hey. You're listening to WBAI, New York 99.5 FM, the cat station for cats.